live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about, could fast food expose people to harmful chemicals? George Washington University has the answer. Then we're going to look at transfer of gut bacteria impacts your brain function and your nerve fiber insulation. The Icahn School of Medicine. What does that mean? I'll explain why it's so important for people with MS, learning disabilities, children who are vaccine damaged, and virtually everyone aging. We want to get the right bacteria transferring up to the brain. And can positive memories help treat mental health problems, emotional problems? University of Liverpool. Then we're going to look at fatty diets leading to daytime sleepiness and poor sleep at night. University of Adelaide in Australia. And sugar, the addictive enemy hiding in plain sight, and why we should pay more attention to what's in all that that makes something sweet. And as summer approaches, we should be extra focused on keeping our immune system strong. A good study about what allows us when spring becomes summer and we're hit with high heat to keep ourselves from coming down with illnesses. And probiotics, once again, shown to reduce cancer risk, UCLA, and a lot more. Then we're going to look at some special issues. And we're going to talk about, and this is important, the idea of who pays for war. Soldiers speaking out about the predicament of military contracting. Then I will add in a quote, and I'd like to see if you know who is going to be the author of the quote, and then I'm going to share a short commentary about what it costs that we're not looking at when it comes to war. Who's really profiting from it? How much are they making? How many people are involved? How do they end up being the ones always invited on television, radio, and NPR, and New York Times quote, of justifying it? It's a scam. And we'll have that from Tom Engelhart on a very important piece from Tom's Dispatch. Then we're also, if time permits today, a short piece from, I was watching a program to see how they were going to handle the issue of who would be better for the economy, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Well, Asher Edelman, a Wall Street godfather, came on and he gave an interesting insight that startled the panel. Also today, a new study, major study out of England, shows that antidepressants, all antidepressants, were not effective, more than a placebo, a sugar pill. Well, hold on. We're talking about tens of millions of women in the United States and children taking antidepressants. They're worthless? Well, they're worse than worthless. They're dangerous. They can create suicide and mania. You know, the people go into schools and shoot up, and we like to blame it just on guns? Well, why don't you see how many of those people who were shooters were on medications? Why does the media never bring that up into a discussion? But they don't. We will today. So we have a lot to share. Plus today, the Huffington Post, which is considered like the must-read for the corporate liberal establishment, has also taken the position of banning a film review of the film Vaxxed. Vaxxed is about the all pro-vaccine people, including Andrew Wakefield, and talking about the cover-up of bad science on vaccines and autism in young African-American boys by the CDC. And who is the center of the film? The center of the film is actually the whistleblower, William Thompson, from the CDC. So it's kind of hard to say that there's a conspiracy nut out there saying the CDC. No, it's a real conspiracy, and the person saying it is from the CDC heading that program, and the author of the, and he's being honest. Why can't we handle the truth? So what I'm doing today is I'm going to advocate that the people in this audience worldwide go to our websites. You can go to my GaryNull.com or my Facebook or Progressive Radio Network, and we are posting today all three of my multi-award-winning documentaries that are not pro-vaccine. We don't apologize for the truth. Andrew Wakefield does. He's too smart not to know the truth. Anyone who looks for the truth will not be pro-vaccine. And yet, I have seen at least, I'm going to guesstimate around 80% of the people who've had their own children damaged, who now head vaccine groups, advocacy groups, and quite frankly, some of them raise millions of dollars, but they're all pro-vaccine. So when I challenge them, as I recently did at a film festival, one of my films, The Sign of an Epidemic, won the festival. And I will not mention the person, but they are well known within the vaccine damage injury movement. And I said, I've spent over 15,000 hours studying every single study, but from a different perspective. I teach a course in research methodology, so I know how to read a study to see is it well-designed or not. And there's not a single well-designed study from the pro-vaccine that can support the safety and efficacy of any given vaccine on any given individual. It's not possible. It doesn't exist. But I have all these other studies that are well-designed to show you the toxicological damage of vaccines, like aluminum and mercury and polysorbate 80. So here's the question. There are at least six individuals I know. I'll name you three. Dr. Nancy Banks from Harvard and Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Let's just stop with those two. I can mention Dr. Tony Bark. Each one has committed between 10 to 15,000 hours of research. They were all pro-vaccine. When they looked at the real scientific evidence, they saw that this is the biggest public fraud in history. And then when they looked further, they saw the reasons why it is a fraud, from how vaccine companies were regularly sued for damage until they got a lobbyist, his name is Dick Armey, who was in Congress, to lobby to get them to pass a bill that exonerated them, that identified them. You cannot sue a vaccine manufacturer, no matter what the damage. And then all the money they make. And so I went through this whole thing and I said, so why are you still pro-vaccine? And there was just this moment where the person didn't have a responsible answer. I said, if you haven't found the research yourself, why don't you call and do a discussion with any of these people? I gave them five names and their contact. Because if you continue to be pro-vaccine after knowing the truth, then the issue is not having a safe vaccine, because that's what the pro-vaccine people who have had damage to themselves or their children want. We are pro-vaccine, but we're looking for the good vaccine. Well, show me the good vaccine. I defy anyone in this audience. We're listened to by scholars and physicians. Prove it to me. Show me the safe vaccine. And then do one more thing. If you're so self-righteously committed that these are safe and effective, then inject yourself with a full complement of everything you're going to put into a baby in the first 2 years of life. After all, you're not a baby. Your body's big. You can handle that, right? Better still, squirt the injections out of syringe into a spoon and drink it. After all, you're putting it into the bloodstream, bypassing all the natural defense mechanisms. If you drink it, you're going to be able to neutralize a lot with that hydrochloric acid. So if you're really confident, show it. Show it on yourself. Then show us the science. You can't, you won't. So we want you to look at the somewhere between 25 and 35 articles, all fully documented, all scholarly, all made, written. Richard Gell and myself have written them. We've posted them all today. So if you really want the truth, read them. If you want to see what the real scientists have to say, watch the documentaries, because you'll see uncompromised toxicologists, uncompromised immunologists who go on the record, especially with the silent epidemic and especially with Autism Made in USA. And I still support watching the film Vax, simply because it shows the mass of Americans another point of view, the corruption. And it's really just about the corruption and the lies. But still, people will support pro-vaccine in spite of all the evidence given. So we have a lot to share today. Let's begin. And we always begin by trying to give people information that can make a difference when it comes. And one of the things that makes a difference is making the right selections in your food choices. So here is a simple issue. This is from George Washington University. Most Americans eat fast food. Now, not all Americans eat fast food every day, and not all Americans eat the preponderance of their diet every day, but more people under 35, the majority of the food they eat is considered fast food. What's the problem? Well, forget the burnt crust in a pizza, which is acrylamides, which is cancer-causing and pro-inflammatory, and forget the pastrami, the meat that never goes bad, and anything that doesn't go bad is bad for you, with the exception of honey. And there you get the heterocyclic amines causing cancer and really strong inflammatory, and the grilled barbecued ribs and the deep-fried fries and chicken, all of that creating and speeding up of your aging process. Here's what George Washington University wanted to know. What about the chemicals? What about the chemicals known as, say, phthalates? And, quote, people who consume lots of fast food tended to have levels of phthalates in their urine that were 24% to 40% higher than people who rarely ate them at all. Quote, we found statistically significant associations between the amount of fast food consumed in the prior 24 hours and the level of two particular phthalates found in the body. Now, why is that important? Because these are extremely pro-inflammatory. Why should that be of concern? Well, because you can end up having the male, you end up defecting your sperm, therefore you end up having defective babies and miscarriages, malformed babies. You end up with childhood behavioral problems in children who eat these fast foods. You end up with children with chronic asthma from eating these fast foods. So, and with adults, diabetes, cancer, and arthritis, and brain damage, liver damage, all from these chemicals and fast foods. So at least they have a study now showing it. The gut contains bacteria, lots of them. You have more bacteria in your gut than you have cells in your body. This is from the Icahn School of Medicine. Quote, specific combinations of gut bacteria produce substances that affect myelin content and cause social avoidance behaviors in mice, according to a study conducted at the Icahn School of Medicine, Mount Sinai, and published in the journal eLife. The research suggests that targeting intestinal bacteria or their metabolites could be one way to treat debilitating psychiatric disorders and demyelinating diseases like multiple sclerosis. By the way, multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disorder. And what happens when you have multiple sclerosis is the damage to your myelin. Myelin is M-Y-E-L-I-N. And that's the insulating sheath around the axons of nerve cells that allows for faster electrical impulse conduction. And myelination is critical for everyday brain function. So damaged myelin results in altered synaptic transmissions and clinical symptoms. And therefore, whatever you can do to lessen damage to the myelin or help in the repair of the myelin, the better your brain and central nervous system is going to function. And they're saying it's all about the microbiota modulating multiple sclerosis. So what does it mean in just lay language? It's relatively straightforward. Good bacteria, good myelin. Bad bacteria, bad myelin. Where do you get the good bacteria? Well, a healthy plant-based diet, lots of juices, chlorophyll, chlorophyllin, which comes from the chlorophyll, all the antioxidants and phytonutrients from berries and beans and pulses and legumes and tubers and garlic and onions and walnuts and juices galore. That creates good bacteria. Plus sauerkraut, great for you, and drinking sauerkraut juice is great for healing ulcers and helping with inflammation in your intestines. And aloe vera is great, and coconut oil is great, and essential fatty acids are all good. Olive oil is good too. All healing, anti-inflammatory. But they also help establish good bacteria. And then your feminine foods like miso and tempeh and tofu, good bacteria. Or just take a probiotic, a good probiotic. All good. Bad bacteria? What I just mentioned, the average American diet. Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, sugar, soft drinks. So it's that simple. It's not complicated. The complication comes when we spend years doing the wrong thing and end up with a disease manifestation and then wonder why. From the University of Liverpool, researchers want to know the effectiveness of using positive memories and images to help generate positive emotions. And it's been suggested that savoring positive memories can generate positive emotions. Increasing positive emotion can have a range of benefits. We've talked about this many times. You reduce stress. You bring down your blood pressure. You can bring down your blood sugar. You can increase the healing microbes in your body. You can reduce cortisol and stress hormones. You increase your blood flow. All that from positive thinking and positive images. So what I suggest is, and this study confirmed that, and that the intervention of eliciting positive images and thoughts was extremely important. And yet the older we get, the more a fog of social memory occurs. Some things that were good in our background, we've forgotten. Some things were bad, we overemphasize. And that's why I have a simple way of doing this is called living your life in reverse. What that means is that you start now, and you go back to what we call remarkable moments, the things that you really appreciated, things that were exciting, maybe something new, maybe a place you visited for the first time. Just looking out over the Grand Canyon, if you've never been there, it's one of those ooh-ah moments. It's just breathtaking. And or being at a place, just walking down the beach. That's why I used to love living in South Beach because, in fact, if it weren't for the beach, I wouldn't have been there. But morning, I'd be alone on that beach for 10-mile run, five up and five back. And then as the sun rises, you're capturing that energy, the ions off the water, and it's just magical. It sets the tone for the whole day. Well, you're remembering that, and all you have to do is focus on that. But let's say that you went with some friends to dinner, and you laughed, and you had fun, and you shared positive energy. That's a remarkable moment. So you focus upon what it was like. Now, it's not important today if those memories are not reoccurring or if the friends have moved or died or whatever. It's that they happened. So you share those memories at that moment. Last night, I was doing a lecture, and I was talking about something and counseling people and how not everyone who says they want to change really want to change. But if it makes them seem hip and together, oh yeah, okay, I'll do it. And a friend of mine was a friend of, I will not mention the name, but a very famous actor. And I was visiting my friend because I was in L.A. doing a film shoot. And I always stayed over there because we've been buddies for 25 years. And he said, I got a friend, a neighbor, just down the street here, we can walk, who's not well and really needs to change. And so we went in over there. I said, sure, I'll help if I can. So we went over that night, went into the guy's house, and there's a whole lot of people there. I mean, it was a big gathering, and this was just kind of normal for them. And I was introduced, and this guy said, oh, you know, your friends tell me about you're this, you know, nutrition guy, and you can help. And yeah, I'm willing to do it. And I said, well, how much are you willing to change? He says, brother, whatever I need to change, I'm going to change because I don't like where I'm going and I need to get back on my health. And I said, all right. I said, well, do you want to change everything at once? Or do you want to change just one thing at once? He says, well, the reality is, let's just start by changing one thing. what would be the one thing that I could change? And I said, well, the one thing that everyone should change is sugar. He says, okay. I says, so can we get rid of all the sugar in the house? He said, you bet. He says, you tell me what to do so I can still eat something that's sweet because I like sweets, but I don't want the sugar, and I'll bet that will help. And I said, yes. So I said, we're going to get rid of everything, all the sugar, got a big bowl of sugar, took it in, threw it down the toilet, and I came back. My friend came over and says, we got to leave now. I said, why? He said, that was not sugar, that was cocaine. Yes, you're kidding. You just poured about $50,000 of the cocaine in the toilet. I said, it looked like sugar to me. He said, we should leave now. So it was one of those funny, remarkable moments. And it happened a long time ago. And of course, the guy never asked me for my help after that. And that was all right. And I think most people in Hollywood have more cocaine in their house than they do sugar anyhow. Your remarkable moments can be exciting. They can be insightful. Sitting at a Krishnamurti lecture, that's a unique moment to hear one of the great minds of all time. So focus upon writing down in a simple diary the remarkable moments of your life. And if you have any photographs to go with them, then look at the photograph and remember that time, because it's all in your brain. It's locked into your cells for life. You see, we never forget anything. That's a misnomer that somehow, oh, I've forgotten that. You may not be able to retrieve it immediately, but it's never lost. Everything you've ever experienced in your life is still in your cells. It's in your DNA. It's being able to relax enough and then focus upon that. And then when you know you're really connected, when you feel the emotions of the experience that you had, and that's why sometimes when we're listening to old-time music and suddenly you just feel transformed because it's putting it all together for you. Now we're finding out that that can help with overcoming sadness. It can help with many of the down feelings or depression, and it works. And finally, fatty diets lead to daytime sleepiness and poor sleep. This is the University of Adelaide. And they found that when you're having all these fats in your diet, and most diets are fat, the fat, A, it's terrible for your blood. It makes it a lot more likely you're going to have a stroke within 2 hours after a fatty meal. In fact, at the Institute of Applied Biology, we used to take people's blood after a meal, about 2 hours after a meal, and before their blood was, you could see the red blood cells were spaced and not aggregating. Afterwards, you'd see this clumping and these streaks of this white. That's the fat from the meal. But it also impacts the body's natural apostat mechanism, and it makes you fatigued. So that's why a lot of people are very sleepy, tired after having a fatty meal. Oh, and by the way, I mentioned sugar. Sugar is something that we consume all the time. We have over 200 studies from peer-reviewed literature showing the dangers of sugar. The trouble is everyone says, well, in excess. Any sugar is in excess when it comes to its danger. And you don't want any processed sugars at all in your body. And you don't have to have them. There are a lot of other natural sweeteners. But an article published in PLOS One, a scientific journal, talked about sugar addiction is virtually equal to nicotine addiction. And so you have to wean yourself off because what the sugar molecule does to receptors in your brain to make you feel deprived if you don't have it. So be understanding and empathetic with people who are giving up sugar. A lot of times they can't just go cold turkey because they'll end up with a sugar craving. And therefore, it's always best to start by shifting people from the amount of sugar they're consuming to, let's say, like a coconut sugar, which it won't impact your glycemic index, or some maple syrup, so that you take them into a natural sugar and you start lessening it. And then at a certain point, you give them fruit that will satisfy some sweet taste but doesn't have the calories until maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks before you really wean them away. And then they're going to feel a whole lot better. And if keep your immune system strong, by the way. The things that will strengthen your immune system, vitamin D, good sleep, making sure that you get all your fruits and vegetables to keep your immune system strong, and especially important are the mushrooms. The more mushrooms go into your system, the better it is. So you want to make sure that you're getting mushrooms. You can saute some shiitake mushrooms and put it into brown rice or miso soup or portobello mushrooms, or a reishi mushroom, but make sure you're getting mushrooms every day because one of the best things in the world is to stimulate your immune system. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy,
oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, cause the woman that you love is gone.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I want to quote someone here. This is a statement, and it's an extremely reasonable statement. And here's what it says. It says, let's fight to make sure our so-called allies in the Middle East and Saudis and the Egyptians stop oppressing their own people and suppressing dissent and tolerating corruption and inequality and mismanaging their economies so that their youth grow up without education, without prospects, without hope. The ready recruits of terrorist cells. Let's fight to make sure that the arms merchants in our own country stop feeding the countless wars that rage across the globe. Who said that? Barack Obama. In a speech in 2002 when he was just a state senator, he denounced the looming invasion of Iraq, but also human rights abuses by our so-called ally, Saudi Arabia. Okay, that's what he said. Nice statement. I support it. But let's jump ahead. According to The Intercept, 13 years later, Obama is making his fourth trip to Saudi Arabia. He has presided over the record-breaking U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia while offering no criticism of their human rights violation. And he won't be asking them to stop cutting off heads and crucifying the headless victims. He won't ask them to stop beating women and giving them no rights at all. He won't ask them to stop killing thousands of innocent civilians in their campaigns and other areas of the Middle East, including the poorest nation in the Middle East. I'll get that to that in a moment. In fact, he was so happy with Saudi Arabia that the United States actually supported the 47-member UN Human Rights Council to make Saudi Arabia become its head. So the group, Saudi Arabia, that beheads more people than any other country in the world has official policy because of its radicalized religious Wahhabism, they now head the UN Human Rights Council, all because our president wanted it. If he didn't want it, it wouldn't happen. But why? What could possibly be the motive? Well, did Obama say, hey, that blogger in Saudi Arabia who is a human rights blogger, do you really need to give him 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes? Because 1,000 lashes will kill any human being. And that was before he went there. No, he did not. Didn't even mention it. So much for speaking out for human rights people. And it's clear that it's about the money. In fact, this president has caused more weapons of mass destruction and death to be sold to Saudi Arabia than any other president in American history. With no qualms. And all the human rights abuses as well. $46 billion this year, $120 billion, and then another $190 billion in training. And so it's a lot of billions to Saudi Arabia. This is the other side of that. This is from Shireen Tarbolesi from Open Democracy. Quote, last week a royal Saudi charity announced that it would donate $224 million, which is a lot of money, to help those in the grip of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. But meanwhile, the ongoing blockade of the Saudi-led coalition combined with escalating violence pushes the country towards a famine. Then it goes on to talk about how Saudi Arabia, for the last 14 months, has been bombing daily Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East. And they have killed all these innocent civilians. They bombed schools and hospitals. Not a word from the Obama administration. And in fact, they're actually flying American-made aircraft using American-made bombs, and including cluster bombs, which are illegal, and all to get to kill the Houthis who are rebelling against the corruption of a Saudi puppet that was in power. So it doesn't matter to the United States how many people are victims. 16 million people in Saudi in Yemen right now do not have food and water. It is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Right behind that would be the severe famine in Ethiopia, where 9 million Ethiopians are at risk of dying from starvation. But you wouldn't know this reading the New York Times or any of the mainstream media or the President of the United States. And the person behind all of it, Saudi Arabia, the beheaders in chief. So why? Everything about our body politic is corrupt. Everything. Everything about Washington is corrupt. All of our bureaucracies are corrupt. They're bloated. They're cancerous. They're metastasizing. And yet we support them. We pay for them. Why? If we want to be honest and ask, how large a government do we need? How many agencies do we need to see that we are protected and our interests are served with civilian insight and oversight? We would have 80% of our government gone. The military-industrial complex closed down with except a small amount. We have all these presidential candidates say, more for the army, more for the military, more for the... more. They have $1.5 trillion a year. And most of it is wasted or corrupted into 200,000 private corporations in the Washington, D.C. area whose lobbyists used to be senators or legislators or members of the White House staff who are now on the boards, generals, admirals. They're all there. They're all feeding at this trough every day. We don't need it. And yet they control the media, they control the think tanks, they control the so-called experts that are on television. And so we're led to believe that we need to keep spending massive amounts. How much do we actually need to defend our country? Right now, we have a larger military buildup than all the other nations the world combined, times 10. So we don't have to fear anyone. It's just gluttony at the most obscene level in human history. And yet you wouldn't know that listening to the, you know, the people talk about how they're going to give more to the military and, of course, give less to the inner cities, to the schools, to those who actually need it. I want to share some figures with you and some insights. And this is from Tom Englehart from Tom Dispatch. Quote, "It's a scam, the American way of war in the 21st century. Let's begin with the $12 billion, billion in shrink-wrapped $100 bills, all of it gone. It disappeared. That would make it the greatest theft in world history. In fact, that would make it a greater theft than all the other thefts combined of cash in world history. And yet not a word. Now, it wouldn't be that difficult finding out where all that money went, but it all went into Baghdad. They were delivered on C-130 planes. The Bush administration began to fly all this money in there. No accountability. That was in 2003. Essentially, they dumped it into a void that was once the Iraqi state. It was stolen. It ended up years later, some of it, about $1.6 billion, in a mysterious bunker in Lebanon. And that's just what happened at the starting gun of the war. It's never ended. In 2011, the final report of the Congressionally Mandated Commission on Wartime Contracting estimated that somewhere between $31 billion and $60 billion in taxpayers has been lost to complete fraud for the so-called reconstruction of Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, for instance, there was the $75 million police academy initially held as, quote, as crucial to the U.S. efforts to prepare Iraqis to take control of the country. It was, however, so poorly constructed that it proved to be a health hazard and was never used. There are 75 million gone. In 2006, quote, feces and urine rained from the ceiling in the student barracks. and that was only the beginning of the problems. When the bad press started, Parsons Corporation, the private contractor that built it, agreed to fix it for nothing more than the pricey sum already paid. A year later, the New York Times reporter visited and found, quote, the ceilings are still stained with excrement, parts of the structures are crumbling, and the sections of the building are unusable because the toilets are filthy and non-functioning, end quote. That's just normal and par for the course. Typically enough, the Kanban Sod Correction Facility, a $40 million prison Parsons also contracted to build, was never even finished. Were they paid? You bet. And these were hardly isolated cases of problems specific to Iraq. Consider, for instance, those police stations in Afghanistan believed to be crucial for, quote, standing up a new security force in that country. Despite the money poured into them and endless cost overruns, many were either never completed or never built, leaving new Afghan police recruits camping out in tents. And the police were hardly alone. Take the $3.4 million for an unfinished teacher training center in Afghanistan that an Iraqi company was contracted to build using, of course, American dollars, and from which it walked away. Money in hand, never did anything. What happened? Nothing. And why stick to buildings when there was those Iraqi roads to nowhere paid for by American dollars? And at least one of them did at least prove useful to move insurgent troops, moving their guerrillas around, and that was $37 million. There was a bridge to nowhere. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built between Afghanistan and Tajikistan that helped facilitate the region's booming drug trade in opium and heroin. So the opium and dealers had a nice new road paid for by American taxpayers, protected by American service personnel, but we paid for it. In Afghanistan, Highway 1 between the capital Kabul and the southern city of Kandahar, unofficially dubbed the Highway to Nowhere, was so poorly constructed it began crumbling in just the first few months in the winter after it was built. And don't think that this was an aberration. The U.S. Agency for International Development hired an American nonprofit, International Relief and Development, to oversee an ambitious road-building program meant to gain the support of rural villagers. $300 million later, they only had built less than 100 miles of gravel road. 100 miles of gravel, but they spent $300 million. Well, that's about $290 million profit for someone. Each mile of the road by then cost U.S. taxpayers $2.8 million instead of the $290,000, while a quarter of the road building funds reportedly went directly to the nonprofit administration staff. These NGOs, man, NGOs are so, the majority are so corrupt. And that's what you see in Haiti and everywhere else where there's money to be made. Quote, the U.S. government funded at least 15 large-scale programs and projects, grew from just $1 billion to $3 billion, despite governments questioning their effectiveness. They were never used. How about this? A gas station. A gas station where? Well, it cost a lot of money. It was $2.5 million, and then it went up to $25 million. But it was never used because they built it where they didn't use that kind of gasoline. Oh, well. And so it goes. There were billions of dollars in aid that no one could account for, and a significant percentage of the 465,000 small arms, rifles, machine guns, grenade launchers, missing, shipped to Afghanistan and simply missing. More recently, there was the Task Force for Business Stability Operations, an $800 million Pentagon project to help jumpstart the Afghan economy. It was shut down after 6 months, and yet in response to requests from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the Pentagon swears there are, quote, no Defense Department personnel who can answer questions about where the money went. Where did $800 million go? No one knows. No one cares. After all, it's just the taxpayers paying for it. So when we're talking about taxes, why don't we look at the $2 to $3 trillion that we have spent and the up to $6 trillion that we will spend on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have nothing to show for except death and depleted uranium, toxic environments. And we're paying for that. Corporate America is gaining from it, and corporate America makes billions and pays no taxes. We pay taxes and gain nothing for it. If we gain peace, it would be worth it. We gain no peace. Neither we nor the people in these countries have any possibility of closure when people continue to exploit conflict. So the next time you hear these individuals telling you that we need more money and we have to get tough and Bill O'Reilly needs troops on the ground, then ask why, except to make profit for individuals, because that's all it's for. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over now and say hello to my guest, who's a newsmaker guest, and we're going to take a look at Fukushima 5 years hence. He is Joe Mangano, and he's the executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project, which is a nonprofit organization founded by scientists and physicians to understand the relationship between low-level nuclear radiation and public health and the risks of cancer and damage to newborns. Joe's published numerous articles and also a book called Low-Level Radiation and the Immune System Disorders, An Atomic Era Legacy. And his website is radiation.org. Nice to have you with us today, Joe.
Likewise, Gary. Nice talking to you.
Joe, there are several issues that people are not aware of, and I'm going to look at the larger issue. Yes, it's 5 years since the Japanese tsunami that devastated the nuclear reactors at Fukushima, resulting in explosions and meltdowns that has spewed massive amounts of radiation material in the atmosphere and across Japan's soil and spilling into the Pacific Ocean. And also 5 years later, the Japanese government and nuclear corporations such as TEPCO have yet to get the situation under control, and radioactive waste continues to leak into the environment. And also 5 years hence, the human cost due to illness and death directly due to radiation exposure continues to be denied by authorities. An actual real figure seem to be in non-existence. So please lay out for us what the cost of Fukushima catastrophe so far have been. And just like Glenn Beck and others says, oh, there were only 5,000 people who died from a Chernobyl meltdown. No, it was 1 million. They just didn't look at the 5,000 articles in Slavic language that showed 1 million casualties. So what are the real casualties looking like? And why, Joe, with one of the largest populated city in the world, Tokyo, with 40 million inhabitants and relatively small area, and over 129 or so million people affected in Japan, why have we not looked at the health consequences to a continuing disaster upon that larger population? The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, you really sort of started what I was going to say, and that is that there are some misconceptions here on the part of the general public. One is that Fukushima occurred in 2011 and ended in 2011. It didn't. It was a meltdown that affected three reactor cores and one reactor waste site. And still, to this day, is not controlled. Every single day, it continues to spew radioactive materials in the form of particles into the Pacific Ocean, where it moves, you know, along the Japanese coast and across the Pacific towards the North America. The other item is, as you said, what are the human costs here? That's the basic question. You know, everyone would agree that a meltdown is not a good thing, but how many casualties did this occur? And, you know, we're going to be studying Fukushima for many years, but 5 years is enough time to get an idea of generally, you know, how many people have suffered from this terrible tragedy. Here's what has happened so far, Gary, and this has occurred not just with Fukushima, but with prior meltdowns, the Three Mile Island meltdown in 1979 and the Chernobyl meltdown in 1986. There is from the established public health agencies, there is a a shutting of the eyes, a denial to even study just basic things like what were the changes in disease rates and death rates. A look through the published medical literature shows, aside from our group, and I'll get to that, it shows two articles that actually looks at disease and death rates from Fukushima. One is a study of thyroid cancer among Fukushima's area's children, which is bad enough. There's at least 127 confirmed cases of the disease, where by this point a normal population should have about 5 or 10. And then there's another article about another type of child thyroid problem, ectopic intrathyroidal disorders, which are extremely high as well. Otherwise, there has been a complete denial. Instead, if you look through the literature, you will see, I counted 51, and I'm sure there are more than that, 51 articles which looks at the mental issues related to a meltdown, stress, behavioral changes, fears, even things like average blood pressure changes, which have gone up, but of course blamed on the meltdown. This is a deliberate deception on the part of the public health research community, which was also done in the prior meltdowns. You know, after Three Mile Island, not a single journal article appeared nearly 12 years on the basic question, what were the changes in cancer rates near Three Mile, you know? And when that was finally done, the authors from Columbia University attributed it to stress and later got into literally a fight in the journals with researchers from the University of North Carolina. Same thing happened with Chernobyl for many years. The number 31 was used. 31 of the rescue workers who received extremely high doses and died quickly, that was the only casualty. Now the establishment admits several thousand, but you are correct. The number is a million and even northwards of a million. So that is what we have found so far. In addition to our work, did you want to step in here, or should I continue?
Yeah. I'll just share some additional insights. Although many radioactive materials from Fukushima have a short life, and that's the argument the media says, oh, well, noble gas isotopes and iodine and cesium and strontium, they're now gone. Wrong. The cesium-137, mostly in the soil, strontium-90 and tritium, both are in the ocean, remain, and some of that will remain for hundreds of years. Over 30 million tons of radioactive debris in soil have been gathered and is stored in 9 million large plastic bags, which are now disintegrating, and no one knows what to do with them. And for the past 5 years, between 200 and 500 tons of radioactive groundwater flows through the reactors daily and is readily seeping into the Pacific Ocean. And there are still trillions of becquerels of radiation flowing into the sea, and this will eventually circulate around the globe. And none of that is safe. And although we are witnessing whale die-offs in the Gulf of Alaska that are suspected to be a result of radiation from Fukushima, and high estimates believe enough cesium-137 has been released to equal 500 Hiroshima bombs, and the Japanese government indicates that cesium-137 levels in the atmosphere equal 168 Hiroshima bombs, and Chernobyl spilled out radiation material equal to only 100 bombs. So you're looking at something that was five times more deadly to the environment than Chernobyl. And medically, cesium-137 resembles potassium and is assimilated into the body as such. And similarly, strontium-90 acts as calcium and will be absorbed into your bones. So you may not have the cancer for another 10 or 20 years, but you will have the cancer. And now witnessing infants born to women exposed to Fukushima with extra arms, extra legs, cancers, and women are getting abortions to avoid the higher probability of having a child with the polymyalgia or birth defects. And we know from very sound peer-reviewed medical research that radiation in very small doses contributes significantly to increases in leukemia, myelomas, cancer of the pancreas, lungs, and women's reproductive organs. And these increases are noted in the works of nuclear plants. And last year, someone you know well, Arne Gunderson's group, Fair Winds Energy Education, based on Japanese and TEPCO data, predict over 1 million deaths in the future will be associated with Fukushima. In fact, Greenpeace has found large increases in animal and plant mutations all around the villages in the prefecture. And here in the United States, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute found high levels of radiation, such as cesium, off the West Coast. And there's also been evidence of plutonium from Fukushima having reached Lithuania. An Indian point called the Fukushima on the Hudson is located in the sixth most populated area in the world, New York City. And the location of Indian Point in the event of a meltdown threatens 20 million people. And there, you got 40 million people in a very close proximity. And so we are doing nothing constructive to be honest about the long-term impacts of Fukushima to its own citizens, let alone to the planet, to the oceans. Your final thoughts, please.
Yeah, we also know that there have been no efforts to measure how much radiation has gotten into human bodies, okay? In addition to Greenpeace, like you mentioned, there's a professor at University of South Carolina, Timothy Musso, has been there numerous times, and he finds numerous DNA defects in plants and in animals, in insects especially. So we know this is occurring in humans because they're breathing the same air, drinking the same water, eating the same food. We did find that we know that the radiation from Fukushima drifted across the Pacific, airborne, and arrived at the U.S. West Coast within 4 days. And we know that in the rain and in the air, the highest levels were on the West Coast. And we've published 4 articles. We found that there was a 17% increase in infants born with underactive thyroid diseases and another 17% increase in the following 9 months, these would be fetuses during the meltdown, that in these 5 different birth defects, anencephaly, cleft palate, Down syndrome, and so on, spina bifida, that these occurred as well along in the 3 West Coast states in Alaska and Hawaii. The information is there, and we know that the very young are kind of the canary birds. When we see something wrong with it, we know that it's going to occur among all people as the years go on, and our community needs to be very honest about their research.
Joe, we're not honest about anything in America, and our media refuses to tell the truth, because if you as a journalist went to Tokyo, as Arne Gunderson did, and you put the radiation detecting devices everywhere, on playgrounds, on rooftops, and every single one shows dangerous levels of radiation, that should have been a wake-up call to the 40 million people in the government. Do something now. And bring in the world community and bring in all the greatest scientists in the world. There are answers, but the Japanese government is refusing to address this in an open, honest way, as it does most things. It does not. It's not open or honest. It's a very misogynist society. And the leading woman activist there says they're not going to do anything. So to all the people listening now in Japan, just understand that your government is not telling you the truth. And you don't want to wake up one day 30 years from now with a cancer that could have been prevented. Had they been honest, you would have had a chance to move. Thank you very much for being on today, Joe. Joe Mangano, and the website is radiation.org. Now, I'm going to play a clip, Canadian Broadcasting, CBC, on antidepressants found to have no more effectiveness than a placebo. This is a wake-up call to the millions of people using these antidepressants. You shouldn't use them. The side effects are devastating, from cancers and neurological problems and mania and depression itself and suicide. Now, let's go out of the program today listening to this news clip.
Well, for the millions of patients struggling with depression, putting their faith in medications to feel better, This won't come as happy news. Today, British researchers said several popular antidepressants are essentially no better than a placebo. Our health reporter, Maureen Taylor, is here to explain. Maureen, tell us more about this study.
Well, Peter, this was a review of all of the clinical trials on four antidepressants, and their names will be familiar to many Canadians. They are Prozac, Effexor, Paxil, and Cerazone. Now, Cerazone was withdrawn from the market because of liver toxicity a few years ago, but the other three remain wildly popular. Last year, Canadian doctors wrote 20 million prescriptions for these and similar medications known as SSRIs to the tune of about $1 billion. But you know, Peter, when researchers actually analyzed all of this data, they found that these medications were no better than a dummy pill or a placebo in people with mild and moderate depression. It wasn't that people didn't feel better on the drugs, because they said they did. It's just that people taking the dummy pills felt better too. The only group that seemed to derive some benefit were people with severe depression, and even then, the authors of the study say that benefit was questionable, Peter.
All right. So why were these drugs approved if they're not effective?
You know, that's a good question, because we don't always get the reasoning from the FDA or Health Canada when they approve or don't approve a drug. But here's the reaction to this study from one drug industry representative in the UK.
These medicines have been licensed by a number of regulatory authorities around the world, including here in the United Kingdom, and therefore the regulatory authorities, looking at all the evidence, have determined that they do work better than placebo.
Now, what should people taking these medications
do? But they
do?
Don't. All right? They don't work. All the lies, obfuscation, all the cover-up, they don't. They're harmful. Get talk therapy from a psychologist, some psychotherapist, some psychiatrist. There are reasonable, natural, non-toxic ways of helping with the crisis that you're in. Drugs are not one of them. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day, everyone.
Oh, so listen to me, get up off your knees. Cause only the strong survive. That's what you said.